embarrassing way, and she was glad of the rouge and eyeshadow.
June. It's your birthday in June.
She nodded. The music inside stopped, and they both turned at the sound of the countdown, everyone shouting, 10, 9, 8. June thought that she should be inside with her friends at midnight, but it was too late now. Dr. Cantor began chanting along, too.
4, 3, 2. Happy New Year, June.
Before she could reply or even knew what was happening, his arm was around her and his mouth was on hers. She tasted cigarettes and whiskey and felt his tongue brush against her own. Her mind snapped into focus, and she realized that she must push him away. She used both hands, and he looked back at her, startled. Dr. Cantor, what are you doing?
I'm sorry.
She had expected the same sheepish smile as when he'd admitted to being drunk, but this time he hung his head with proper remorse. June looked around to make sure no one could have seen. You should go home now. The forcefulness of her voice surprised her.
Yes, you're probably right.
She had already taken off his jacket and was handing it back to him.
I'm sorry if I made you feel uncomfortable, June.
His face had crumpled with the stress. It's all right. Just go home and get some sleep. He began to walk away, and she felt deeply relieved. But he turned back.
I'll see you at work.
Yes.
I always see you there. All you pretty girls who have no idea, you're building a very nasty bomb.
He turned and walked away along the boardwalk. June looked around for a second time to make sure no one had heard. She stood motionless for a moment. After wondering for so long what they were working on, she now recoiled from the truth. She had often thought it must be some kind of weapon, but to know it definitively was frightening. The door behind her opened, and she turned to see Cece and Tom. "What are you doing out here?" Cece asked, her voice more annoyed than concerned. "I had just sent Dr. Cantor home."
"Did he give you any trouble?"
Tom asked, beginning to puff up again.
"No, he was fine. You miss New Year's."
June's heart sped up, despite her, at the thought of the kiss.
"I heard. Happy New Year."
"Happy New Year. You must be freezing. Let's get inside." June followed them back into the crowded room. Cece nudged her as they walked back to the table. "Get yourself a soldier. A man like that can't be serious about you." Later that night, June lay in bed with her eyes wide open, listening to the low hum of music from the roller rink. "A bomb," he had said. "A very nasty bomb." It made her feel powerful, excited, even, to know what so many did not, even if she was ignorant of the details. But that wasn't all she was excited about, she had to admit, a smile lingering on her lips. He had kissed her, and she knew that the way she felt about Dr. Cantor right now was the way she should have felt about Ronnie all that time. Dr. Cantor had behaved badly. And yet she didn't care. She couldn't wait to see him tomorrow. Would he talk to her? What should she say? Would he try to kiss her again? She couldn't sleep. Somehow, even with the terrible secret now loose in her mind, she felt too hopeful to worry. And the world was too full of possibility for rest. Chapter 10. Sam awoke on January 1st with a piercing headache and a heavy sense of regret. He was sure he had kissed the plain girl from Y-12, and he had a horrible feeling that he had also told her something he shouldn't have about the project. His memory was cloudy. Everything was pretty much intact up until he left the canteen, but after that, he could only pull up snapshots. Max dancing with a pretty blonde girl, himself spilling punch on the dance floor. The images became increasingly humiliating. Incredible as it seemed, he must have attempted to dance. Then he remembered the cold night air and the girl, June. The ominous word bomb coming from his lips. Oh, God. He spent the bus ride to work, focused equally on rectifying the situation with the girl and not throwing up. He hadn't managed to get a seat and contemplated feigning illness and asking a young lady if he could have hers. He was sinking lower and lower, and beginning to feel completely unfit for human contact. How could he have made such a fool of himself? He drank a lot, yes, but he usually knew how to handle his liquor. The last time he'd gotten so tight that he couldn't remember things the next morning had been years ago at a party in Berkeley, when he'd consumed most of a bottle of rum by himself. How could he have been so mad with drink to talk so loosely? And exactly what had he said? He closed his eyes and tried to push away the nausea rising in his gut. By the time he sat at his desk in the laboratory, at least his stomach was feeling better. He sent an assistant to fetch him coffee. He told himself he must find June and apologize immediately. He would look for her at lunch. If she was working the morning shift, then she should be in the cafeteria. She could turn him in and he could be fired. That was distinctly possible. He knew nothing about her, and that was certainly what she should do, what the army told people again and again they must do. He had to get to her first and hope that she took pity on him. But why should she? He had attacked her in the dark, after all, and why had he kissed her? He must be more desperate for a woman than he realized. She was sweet, or at least she had seemed sweet from what he could remember. Perhaps she would be understanding. The kiss itself, he remembered clearly. The taste and feel of thick lipstick, a soft floral scent, her hot tongue. To his horror, he realized he was becoming aroused, thinking back on it. How much worse could this day become? His body was behaving like he was 13 again, forced to hide humiliating bulges behind his geometry textbook in Mr. Deacon's class. He was 30 now, and this was his laboratory. He had to get control of himself. The coffee arrived, and he gulped it down. June was sure to apply lipstick that morning, and even slipped a tube into her pocket to take to work. She borrowed some of Cece's eyeliner, too. Luckily, Cece was working the evening shift this week, so she was asleep. June didn't think she would mind her using it, but worried that Cece would suspect her reason had something to do with Dr. Cantor. She looked around the bus stop, but didn't see him. On the bus, she was fairly certain that a young man in civilian clothes whom she didn't recognize was staring at her. Was it the eyeshadow? Was she glowing with excitement? There must have been dark circles under her eyes, since she'd hardly slept. She looked out the window, pretending not to notice, but felt a flush. She hoped she saw Dr. Cantor today. Even though she'd only nodded off a couple of hours ago, with all the adrenaline moving through her, she didn't feel tired at all. After half an hour in her cubicle, though, June was yawning. She forced her mind into action to stay awake. What in the world could these dials have to do with a bomb? What was she actually doing? By the time lunch arrived, she was desperate for a break and giddy with the thought of seeing Dr. Cantor. Still, she put on a calm face as she walked to the lunchroom, not wanting to act like one of the ridiculous girls she worked with. She was startled to see him before she even entered the cafeteria, standing by the doorway. It caught her off guard, and she stared at him, unable to think of what to say or do. He waved and motioned for her to follow him across the hallway, so she did. He waited until they were out of earshot of the girls entering the lunchroom before starting, "Miss..." He paused, apparently struggling for her last name. "Walker," she said, "but you can call me June."
"June, I want to apologize for my behavior last night. I don't remember everything, but I'm fairly certain that I acted terribly."
"Don't worry, Dr. Cantor. I know that isn't how you would normally act."
He looked relieved.
"Of course it's not. I made you feel awkward, I'm sure, and it was awful of me. I had far too much to drink, as I'm sure you realized."
She nodded.
"There's something else,"
he continued, and her heart swelled.
"I think I might have spoken out of turn."
"Oh, you did say something."
She looked over her shoulder. No one was nearby, but she was still scared to say too much.
"Yes, I was afraid I did."
He clenched his jaw and looked so upset that she wanted to reach out and stroke him, help him relax.
"It was completely stupid of me. I hope you won't..."
Now he looked over his shoulder.
tell anyone?
No, of course not. You don't have to worry, Dr. Cantor. I'm a friend. His entire body relaxed upon hearing this.
Thank you, June. And please call me Sam.
It sounded so strange and casual that she smiled.
Am I keeping you from lunch?
He asked. Have you eaten yet? She offered.
No. Shall we?
June sat across from Sam, aware that the other girls must be staring at this unexpected coupling, some of whom might have also seen them together at the dance last night. But to her surprise, it didn't bother her at all. She dove into her potato soup with gusto, but Sam seemed hardly interested in his. Aren't you hungry?
I'm not feeling that well today.
He gave her a rueful half-smile. She leaned forward and said softly, You shouldn't drink like that.
I know.
And his tone sounded as if he truly did. You really shouldn't drink at all. His dark eyes considered her, not with such frightening intensity as last night, but still in a direct, forward way.
Tell me, June, have you ever been drunk?
She laughed. No, of course not. I've never had a drink in my life.
Then you can't very well tell me to give it up.
You could get in trouble with the army. And besides, you said yourself you don't feel very good.
Yes, and I made a real nuisance of myself last night. If that's all true, I clearly overdid it. But I don't see that as grounds for giving up drink completely.
The last thing she wanted to do was argue with him, so she gave a little shrug and hoped the conversation would move on.
I'll tell you what. If you drink with me and don't enjoy it at all, then I'll give it up for you.
She laughed again, this time with a nervous edge. No one in her family ever touched alcohol, except for Jericho. But the chance to share more time doing anything with Sam was too exciting to pass up. Okay. When shall we do it? He winced.
Not tonight. Are you free tomorrow?
She was supposed to go bowling with Cece, but could find a way out of it. Yes?
Then we should meet at the canteen. If you've never had a drink, you just might be able to get drunk off the beer they serve here.
For the rest of the day, she was floating above the stool at her cubicle. It was no trouble to stay awake now. She couldn't stop thinking about Sam, what they would do tomorrow, what she should wear. She replayed their lunch over and over again in her head, trying to remember his words, how exactly he had looked at her. He had a deep, rich voice, and she struggled to recall the exact intonation he used when he said her name. Luckily, Tom was to go bowling with them the next night, so Cece didn't much care if June was there or not. June told her that Sally from work had asked her to go to the canteen with her in pursuit of a soldier she had her eye on. This had some precedent, as she had socialized with Sally a time or two, and the redhead was always pining over some boy or another. June knew Cece would never approve of her going out with Sam, let alone drinking with him. June hardly approved of it herself. She just hoped that they didn't run into Cece and Tom while they were out together. And truth be told, Cece barely registered June's change of plans that night at all. Tom was all she could focus on these days. It's so unfair that we can't have boys up to the room. I mean, of course I don't want to do anything indecent with Tom, but the poor thing has to live in this awful army barracks. I just wish I could show him some hospitality. Oh, June, it is too bad you're not coming out tomorrow. Tom's friend Stan just broke things off with his girl. June was pleased with herself for not having to have Stan forced upon her. I'm sure I'll meet him another time. Oh, you must. Cece was in front of her mirror, putting curlers in her hair and talking to June through her reflection. Stan's a swell guy. I think you'd really like this one. Mm-hmm. June got into bed and pretended to fall asleep, imagining Sam's lips through shut eyes. Sam was embarrassed for feeling nervous as he prepared for his date with June. In vain, he searched his room for a jacket without holes in it. He still wasn't sure why he had suggested this. The obvious reason was, of course, that he hadn't been with a girl in so long that the thought of kissing anyone provoked an erection. Still, he had shocked himself by actually asking her out. She was only a factory worker, for God's sake, and she must be very young. She looked as though she should still be in high school, with her soft face and scrawny build. There were plenty of educated secretaries around, school teachers, administrators, even a few lady scientists. They would be much more appropriate for him.
What was he doing chasing after this simple girl? He checked his pockets for all the requisite items, wallet, cigarettes, flask. On his way through the hallway, he gave himself a quick inspection in the mirror. His shirt was wrinkled, his tie stained, his hair badly in need of a trim. He took his overcoat from a hook by the door. Anne stuck her head out of the kitchen where she was washing the dinner dishes.
Headed out to see Max?
Thinking only of how happy she would be to hear it, he said, "No, actually, I have a date." As predicted, she beamed, and Sam immediately regretted telling her. There would be questions he didn't want to answer. He lunged for the doorknob to make a hasty exit. "Have a good time," Anne called, but he was already out in the frigid night air. He turned the collar of his coat up and sunk his hands deep into the pockets. He had a long walk ahead of him. Not wanting to run into Max, Sam had chosen a canteen in another neighborhood. No doubt Max would have been pleased for him. Still, he wanted to keep this to himself. If he himself had mixed feelings about it, there was no sense going and telling other people, he figured. She'd never had a drink in her life. It was sweet, really. She had the local accent, for sure. A real country girl. Never would he have imagined going out with someone like her when he was back in Brooklyn. Still, the way she had handled things yesterday had been excellent, and she had a quiet reserve, which he admired. He got to the door of the canteen, and there she was, waiting in the front, sitting by herself in a blue skirt and a gray sweater that matched her eyes. She smiled when he came in, and he smiled back, surprised by how happy he was to see her. June stared at the mug of beer Sam sat in front of her with trepidation. He sat down beside her with his own mug and took a gulp. She stayed motionless, working up the courage to taste it. "Oh, come on," he said. "This stuff hardly counts as a drink at all." She took a sip. It was bitter, but not that bad. Another sip? Not bad at all. It tasted no worse than black coffee. She wasn't sure what she'd been expecting. "It's all right." "See, I told you." Sam took another gulp of his drink. He was already halfway done with the mug.
"How much do I have to drink to become drunk?"
"You? I don't know. Since you've never had a sip before, you might feel a bit lightheaded after just one of these. But that stuff's so weak, it should take at least two or three." She took another sip. She was becoming used to the taste and was no longer frightened.
"How does it feel to be drunk?"
Sam looked thoughtful. "Depends on what mood you're in, I guess. If you're happy, then drinking can make you even happier, but if you're in a rotten mood, then it just sort of dulls the pain. Makes everything blurry around the edges. Your thoughts don't come so fast." She took a bigger drink this time. Sam took a pack of cigarettes from his pack and offered her one. "You're trying booze. Might as well go all the way and try smoking, too." She was feeling reckless, so she took it and held it out for Sam to light. "You have to suck on it while I light it," he said and demonstrated with his own cigarette. She put it in her mouth and sucked as he held the lighter to it. A scratchy sensation quickly worked its way down her throat, and she began coughing. "Easy, just take little puffs at first." She didn't want to take any more puffs at all. Her stomach felt a bit queasy, and her head was a balloon. But Sam was watching her expectantly, so she took another. Without realizing what she was doing, she blew the smoke out her nose, and Sam laughed.
"I don't think I like it,"
she said, handing the cigarette back, unable to go on.
"Where are you from?"
"New York City. But I was living in California before coming here."
"Wow. New York and California. Just like a movie star."
"Not exactly."
"Still, I've never been out of East Tennessee."
"You grew up near here?"
"Yeah, and my mother grew up right here. Can you believe that? Where Y-12 is now, my grandfather used to have a farm."
"Imagine that."
"You must feel like you're in the middle of nowhere here."
He finished his beer. "Elk Ridge isn't exactly the middle of nowhere, but it's like nowhere else on Earth, that's for sure."
"Do you miss your family?"
"Yeah. My father's dead, but Ma writes letters every week like clockwork. I worry about her all by herself in Brooklyn. Although my sister's nearby."
"When's the last time you saw her?"
"About 4 years ago, before I moved to California."
June glanced at his empty glass. "Do you want some more?"
No, I have something better.
He gave a cautious look around the room and produced a silver flask from the inside pocket of his jacket. What's that?
Splow.
She laughed to hear him use such a hillbilly word. You better be careful of that stuff. He took a sip and squinted in what appeared to be pain.
You want some?
No, thanks.
That's probably wise.
He took another sip and then put it back in his pocket.
You need another beer.
Sure enough, she'd emptied her glass. She wondered if she was drunk, but didn't think so. Sam was already gone to buy her another. His jacket had a hole under the arm, which she found endearing. By the time they left the canteen, June had finished 4 beers, and she thought there was a good chance she had succeeded in getting drunk. She'd noticed when she went to the ladies' room that even after she'd stopped walking, she still had the sensation that the room was moving. She wasn't stumbling over anything, like drunk people in the movies. But she felt happy. Every time Sam looked at her, she couldn't help but smile. She hoped he'd kiss her before they said goodbye for the night.
"Where do you live?"
he asked. "West dormitory?"
"That's on my way home, but it's a long walk."
"I don't mind walking. I don't even feel cold." She touched her cheeks. "My face feels so hot." Sam gave her a worried look.
"Oh, dear."
"What?"
"I think we've done it."
She giggled.
"I hope I haven't corrupted you terribly."
She walked along beside him on the boardwalk. All her nervousness from earlier in the evening was gone. She felt like she could say anything to him.
"How old are you?"
30.
"Have you ever thought about getting married?"
"Not really, no. Have you?"
"Yes."
She looked at the muddy boards beneath their feet.
"I had a fiancé. He was killed last September in France."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
She felt a sudden desire to tell him all about Ronnie, and she never wanted to talk about Ronnie to anyone.
"We grew up together. His name was Ronnie, and he was only 18. I mean, I'm only 18, but he's dead."
"It's a damn shame."
"Have you ever been to France?"
"No."
"I keep trying to picture it, where he died. To think he was all alone on the other side of the world."
"Sometimes I feel like a real coward for not being over there myself."
"Oh, but you shouldn't. A mind like yours shouldn't be wasted on the battlefield. You're doing important work here. I mean, I don't know what sort of work, but I'm sure it's important."
"Oh, but I hate to think of so many good men dying. Not just men, people. My father's family in Germany. I have so many aunts and uncles and cousins, and who knows what's become of them."
"Your family's German?"
"Yes, but we're Jewish."
"Oh."
She had never met anyone who wasn't Christian before, at least not that she knew of.
"So you don't know where your family is?"
"No. But from everything I hear, it sounds like they're probably dead."
"I'm sorry. Sometimes I feel so lucky to be here, safe in America, and I can hardly understand how it is that I am safe here when so many people around the world are dying."
She worried he'd think she was foolish, but he was nodding.
"I do, too. I think, what if my father hadn't come to America? I'd still be back there. What of my brother? Why is he stuck who knows where in the Pacific Ocean, and I'm here drinking beer with a pretty girl?"
"I don't deserve it. I don't deserve to be so lucky."
"But you're hardly lucky, June. You lost your fiancé."
He gave her such a kind, pitying look that she wanted to tell him the truth.
"No. It's not like you think. You see..."
She took a deep breath, then forced the words out quickly.
"I didn't love him. Not the way a woman is supposed to love her husband. He asked me to marry him just before he shipped out, and I didn't know what to do, so I said yes. But I didn't love him."
Before she even realized what was happening, she had let out a big, sobbing cry. She couldn't control herself and had to stop walking. Her humiliation only made her cry more. She squeezed her eyes shut and felt his arms encircling her. He felt warm and strong. When she put her arms around his shoulders and leaned into him, crying into the rough wool of his coat.
"I'm sorry," she croaked. "I don't usually cry like this."
"It's all right. Oh, June, it's all right. You have nothing to apologize for. I mean, you've done nothing wrong.
I didn't love him.
That's not your fault.
She wanted to believe he was right. The tears stopped, but she kept her face pressed into his shoulder. After a moment, he gently pushed her back and looked down at her face. She felt self-conscious and knew that the eyeliner was probably smeared all over her face now. He brought his hand to her face and gently wiped away the remaining tears. Then he tipped her chin up and brought his mouth down to meet hers. This time she wasn't taken by surprise, and she didn't push him away. She kissed him back, not quite sure what to do, but following his lead. He grabbed the back of her head and leaned into her. He pulled his lips away for a moment and pulled off his glasses. His eyes seemed smaller, but as though they could see right through her without the curtains of glass. Before she could say anything, he leaned in and kissed her again. Finally, she pulled away from him. "I don't want to go home," she whispered. She wasn't sure what she meant. It was certainly a reckless thing to say. It could be taken as an invitation, and maybe that's even how she meant it. But mostly, she meant exactly what she said. She didn't want to go home. She didn't want to leave his side or for this night to end.
"Do you want to come home with me?"
he asked.
That almost certainly had to be taken as an invitation.
She became aware of her heartbeat, aware that she was most definitely drunk. She didn't feel herself. Her emotions were heightened. She wanted to say yes to him, but she couldn't say yes. Could she? That was not what nice girls did. What would he think of her if she did? Before she could say anything, he said, "I'm sorry, I shouldn't have suggested that." "No," she said, her own mind now made up. "I'd like to." He looked hesitant. "Really?" she said. "Unless you think that... you think badly of me."
"No, of course not. But I am worried that you've had too much to drink. You're not thinking clearly."
"My mind feels clearer with you than with anyone I've ever met." He kissed her again for what seemed like a long, long time. Sam opened the door to the house slowly, motioning for June to enter. It was late enough that Charlie and Anne would be in bed. He had stressed to June that she must be quiet, and he didn't think she was too drunk to forget. The idea of Charlie and Anne realizing he'd brought a girl home was too humiliating to contemplate. He was acting horribly. Getting her drunk and taking her home like this was fairly despicable, though he suspected that Max did this sort of thing all the time. June was sweet, and would no doubt regret all this in the morning. The entire way to the house, he'd been trying to convince himself to take her home, but every time he was about to turn her around, the feel of her hand in his or the sight of the naked flesh between her scarf and coat was too much for his weak will. His room was on the other side of the house from Charlie and Anne, thank God. He flipped on the light and closed the door behind him. She took off her coat, and he slung it across the back of his chair beside his own. She sat down on the bed and looked up at him expectantly. He wasn't sure what to do, so he sat beside her. He would tell her not to feel pressured, that they didn't have to do anything. But then they were kissing, and he lost his resolve. His hands seemed to have minds of their own, and before he knew it, were pulling her sweater over her head. Luckily, she was grinning when her face reappeared from under the cotton. He took off his own shirt and tie and kissed her again. His hands worked their way to her brassiere. Her breasts were soft and firm and fit perfectly in his palm. She didn't seem to mind his hands there. She continued kissing him hungrily. Now there was no turning back, and his conscience had evaporated. Her skin was so soft, still cool from their long walk outside. He couldn't get enough of touching her, feeling her nakedness pressed into his own. He laid her back on the bed, and she looked like an angel, her hair radiating from her head against the white pillow. Her mouth reached out for his, and he leaned over to kiss her. She pulled back, and he thought she must be coming to her senses, ready to yell at him and tell him to stop. "Sam," she whispered.
"Yes?"
I just feel like I should tell you, I'm not... I mean, it's not my first time. Does that bother you?
The look of concern on her face was so touching that he almost regained his sense of remorse. Of course not. He stroked her cheek for effect. It's not my first time either. Before his conscience reappeared, he knew he must act. As quietly and gently as he could, he began making love to her. After 2 years of celibacy, it didn't take long for him to finish. He collapsed beside her, unsure of how much she'd enjoyed it. They were both trying so hard to be quiet. He held her close to him. The sensation of a body next to his own in this small bed was unfamiliar. He was drifting off, not quite asleep, but dozing and content, when she whispered,
"Sam, the other night, what you said?"
"Mm-hmm."
"A bomb, you said. We're building a bomb."
His eyes opened and he snapped awake. "Yes."
"What kind of bomb? What could possibly take so many people to build?"
Briefly, he wondered if she were a spy. This was exactly the kind of thing a spy would do, get you into bed and ask for your government secrets. But he probably did owe her some explanation after blurting it out like that. He cleared his throat. "We are building a bomb that will be 1,000 times more powerful than any weapon ever created before." He wondered where to begin, how to explain. "Do you know what an atom is?"
"A little piece of something?"
"Sort of. Did you learn about the periodic table in school?"
"Yes, the elements."
"That's right. An atom is the smallest piece of an element you can get that still has all the properties of that element. Does that make sense?"
"Yeah, I think so."
Her eyes were wide open, and she was staring at him eagerly. "The center of the atom is called the nucleus, and it's made up of parts called neutrons and protons. If you break up an atom's nucleus, energy is released. And if you can figure out a way to create a chain reaction where breaking up one atom causes other atoms to break up as well, then you could release a huge amount of energy." It was hard to work himself back to the basics of things, and he wondered just what she'd learned about science in her backwoods high school. But she was nodding. "That's what we're trying to do. Create a bomb that will break up atoms to release energy in a huge explosion. It will be horribly destructive, much worse than any weapon ever created."
"So that's why this town's been built?"
"You would never see this money, these resources, being spent in peacetime. No government would go to this trouble to research cures for diseases or simply advance human knowledge. No, we exert ourselves to this extent only in times of war to invent killing machines. And this, my dear, will be a killing machine worse than any that man has ever dreamed up before."
She looked frightened, and he tightened his arm around her.
It was a relief for once to talk about what they were doing in plain, simple terms. But he'd gotten carried away. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to scare you."
She shook her head. "No, I'm glad you told me. I don't care if it's a crime, I wanted to know the truth."
They were silent after that. The night was cold, but her body was warm. He couldn't tell when she fell asleep or if she was still awake as he began to drift off. Her head was on his shoulder, and he felt the gentle rhythm of her breathing against his skin. Chapter 11 Joe had been on the early shift all week and found he couldn't sleep past 7, much as he wanted to on his day off. He went out to the bathhouse and splashed some water on his face. The ground was hard and sparkling with frost, which made the run-down field of Huttman's look ghostly, pretty, even, in the early morning light. He pulled his ragged jacket tight around his shoulders and walked toward the canteen. He would eat breakfast and write a letter to Mariah. Sometimes he worried he couldn't quite remember what she looked like, which was crazy. They'd been married for 15 years. He could certainly picture her face, but found it harder to conjure her in action. She always had the same expression when he thought of her, shaking her head, perpetually amused and affectionate. But it had been so long since they'd seen each other, it was starting to feel like he was making her up. Like she might not even exist. Not really. She might as well not exist, he thought, and then immediately regretted thinking it. It was good not to be working, yet the days stretched out in front of him, empty and lonely. Ralph was on a different shift. He saw less of the boy these days since he'd started going around with Shirley. Joe didn't know what to make of the girl. When they first started dating, Joe had hoped a woman would settle Ralph down, but it turned out she was even more of a rabble-rouser than he was. Instead of calming him, she'd just gotten him dressing like he was off to a club in Harlem and talking more than ever about double victory. She was a real city girl, and Joe wondered what she saw in Ralph, fresh off the farm. It was clear enough to see what Ralph saw in her. She was undeniably lovely, with wide eyes and full pink lips. She spoke in a clear, strong voice, always confident. Bewitching, almost. If she walked right into Norris Lake, Ralph would probably follow and drown himself without thinking twice. She was never rude to Joe, but never warm, either. She'd graduated from high school a year ago and started working at the Coca-Cola factory in Atlanta. But when she heard she could make more in Oak Ridge, she decided to come north to Tennessee. She said she was saving up to go to school to become a teacher, and told Ralph he should go to college, too. Joe laughed the first time he heard her say it. Ralph hadn't been to school since he was 9 years old. But Shirley said it didn't matter, not if he was smart. Suddenly books started appearing in the Hutman, piled up by Ralph's bed. It was hard for young Negroes on the reservation to date. The only place to socialize was the rec center, but this was hardly a decent place to take a lady, what with all the card games going on. Men were allowed into the women's Hutman area for only a few minutes at a time. They called it the pen, and sure enough, the women were basically locked up there. No one was allowed to be out in the Hutman area after curfew, so Ralph had to meet Shirley in the cafeteria, or take her for a walk in order to court her. Occasionally they took the bus to Knoxville for a real date. Not that Joe had had it much better courting Mariah back in the day. Most of their dating had been done at church. Joe had waited a while to think about getting married. His mother had been anxious and was forever pointing out young girls in town or at church, nudging him toward them. He called on some of them, but none had tempted him to domesticity until Mariah. Something about her was different. She had opinions on most everything and wasn't shy about sharing them. The first time he spoke to her, she'd told Joe he needed to clean his boots before wearing them to church next time. Somehow this wasn't rude or off-putting. No. He'd had a clear sense then that Mariah knew better than he how he should be living his life. In fact, it was Mariah who had first suggested that he go to work in Oak Ridge. Ralph had met a recruiter in town and had told him over dinner one night that he'd decided to go. It hadn't occurred to Joe that he could go along as well. After Ralph had left and the children were in bed, Mariah had brought him a cup of weak coffee made with the grounds left over from the morning. She sat beside him on their small homemade sofa. "You ever think of working in a place like that?"
"What, in Tennessee?"
She nodded.
"I reckon I could do the work. But what about you and the kids?"
Mariah didn't say anything at first.
$38 a week, Ralph says.
Joe nodded. He knew they were both thinking of what they could buy with that money, the countless problems it would solve. Mariah put her hand on the back of his. "You know I could manage on my own." He did. He had never doubted it, except when Ben was sick and he was mad with worry. If anything, now he had a selfish fear that Mariah and the children were doing too well without him. Of course, they relied on the money he sent home, but how much of a difference did it make to the girls and little Ben that he wasn't there to tuck them in at night? Joe looked up from his tray and saw Ralph. The boy would be eating his breakfast and heading to work. Joe waved, and Ralph slumped over to join him. He sat down across from Joe and shoved his tray down hard in front of him.
"Runny grits again," Ralph muttered. "Fourth day in a row. Tomorrow's Sunday. And they usually give us something nice on Sunday. Can't wait for tomorrow, then. Decent more water than grits."
Joe ignored Ralph's sullenness. Their conversations often went like this, each man pursuing his own attitude, all but oblivious to the other.
"It's warmer today, but I reckon we're getting one more cold spell before spring. I hope it snows again." "You crazy? Snow blows right into Hutman. I only seen snow but two times." "Morning, gentlemen."
Joe heard Otis's voice before he even looked up, disappointed to see him joining their table. Ralph, however, seemed to perk up.
Shirley's in line over there.
Otis raised a suggestive eyebrow. Ralph turned to see her, then immediately stared down at his plate. He never talked about Shirley and got shy whenever Joe asked about her.
Good Lord, boy.
Otis laughed.
She's your girl now. You can't still be shy to see her.
As she walked over to their table, Ralph looked up from his breakfast, and she gave him a sweet smile. He smiled back, and for a moment Joe could see the boy he'd been when they first arrived in Oak Ridge.
"Howdy, Shirley," said Otis in his lewd tone.
She gave a tiny nod and said simply, "Otis?" As much as Joe mistrusted the girl, he did admire her obvious disdain for Otis. He gave her an approving,
"Nice to see you, Miss Shirley."
"You too, Joe. Hard day's work ahead?"
"As a matter of fact, it's my day off. I don't know what to do."
"Not much to do in this place," said Ralph. "You could take the bus to Knoxville."
"What would I do in Knoxville?"
"Good question. There's not much to do in Knoxville either." Shirley was grinning, and Joe couldn't tell if she meant this as a joke. He felt like she and Otis laughed at everything, just for different reasons.
"Shirley's from Atlanta," said Otis. "She ain't impressed with our little Tennessee towns."
"You're telling me that you spend a lot of time on the thrilling streets of Knoxville?" Shirley snapped back.
"It ain't Memphis, but you can find entertainment if you know where to look."
"I'm pretty sure Joe isn't after your sort of entertainment." If Ralph felt awkward at the tension between his girl and his friend, he didn't let on, though he did make an effort to steer the conversation back to Joe.
"You could go to the movies."
"Yeah, reckon I could."
"There's a colored camp council meeting later on this afternoon," said Shirley. "Ralph and I are going. You should come too, Joe. It sounds like you don't have anything better to do."
"Oh, no, I'm no help at those meetings."
"Just being there is a help," she insisted. "The bigger our numbers, the more powerful our voices." Joe didn't reply. Ralph knew better than to try and get him to go back to those meetings. But Shirley was hard to say no to. "Besides," continued Shirley, "you might find it interesting." Joe looked at Ralph, who stared down at his grits. Otis chimed in.
"It sure do sound interesting, Joe, but if you decide to skip the meeting, you can always join me for a game of dice."
Joe and Shirley both ignored him. "What do you say, Joe?" she asked.
All right, I guess I can come along."
"Excellent." Shirley turned to Ralph. "I got a letter from my Aunt Lillian. She's bought a house."
"How'd she manage that?" asked Otis.
"Years of hard work and frugal living."
"That's wonderful," said Ralph. "Real good news," Joe added. "She must be quite a woman."
"She is. She and my Aunt Gladys sew some of the most beautiful dresses you can find in Atlanta. They also raised me up from a baby."
"Was it just the three of you?" asked Joe.
Shirley nodded. "Neither of them ever married."
"Ain't you never need a man around the house?" asked Otis.
"No. In my experience, women do just fine without men." Joe's thoughts returned to Mariah.
"Well, surely, you need them for something."
Otis's leer was too much for Ralph.
"Shut up, Otis."
Shirley put her hand on Ralph's. "It's all right. I suppose they are necessary for procreation, but that takes only a few minutes, right, Otis?" Joe dropped his fork and it clattered against his plate. Ralph looked as stunned as Joe felt. Otis, however, laughed.
"Suppose you're right about that."
Joe had never heard a woman talk like Shirley. No wonder Ralph was still nervous around her. Joe himself was nervous around her. After breakfast, Joe decided to go for a walk to get as far away from the buildings and construction as possible. The days were getting warmer, and though he kept his hands thrust into his coat pockets for warmth, the sun felt good on his back. He followed the patchworks of trees. Whenever he came to a crossroad, he turned away from whichever buildings were larger. Eventually, he found an undisturbed meadow full of grass, chickweed, and henbit. No roads, no buildings, no ditches. If he stood just so, all he could see was meadow and trees, as though Oak Ridge didn't even exist. He sat on the roots of a poplar and looked up at the blue sky. Wispy white clouds swirled up above him. He could look at that sky and imagine he was home. He met Ralph back outside the cafeteria when the boy was done with his shift. Ralph looked surprised to see him.
I ain't sure you coming. Got nothing better to do. Besides, your Shirley's mighty persuasive.
They walked toward the rec center. Ralph looked thoughtful.
Shirley does say whatever's on her mind.
Joe tried not to smile too broadly.
She sure does. I don't know what to make of it half the time. Girls grow up different in Atlanta, I reckon.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it might just be Shirley.
Be careful.
They're always telling me to be careful. Shirley ain't dangerous.
All women are dangerous.
The meeting was in a small room around the back of the building, away from the noise and gambling. Shirley was already there, along with a group of something like 12 men, sitting in a circle of chairs. Joe didn't look out of place. Most of them were also construction workers in work clothes and muddy boots, but he felt out of his element. The others all knew each other. Ralph was welcomed heartily as he introduced Joe around. Joe hoped that no one asked him any questions, and he could just sit back and be ignored. When everyone had quieted down and found a seat, a man began to speak. Joe remembered Robert Wales from the last meeting Ralph had dragged him to. He was a small man, yet he carried himself in a way that gave the impression of strength. Back straight, head held high, and a deep, resonant voice that commanded other men to listen.
Thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you to those of you who accompanied me to the meeting with Rowan Anderson last week. I wish I had better news to report back, but as those of you who were there know, it was unproductive.
Ralph spoke up.
Mr. Newman denied all our requests.
There were groans and exclamations. Shirley shook her head in disgust. Wales put up his hand to ask for silence.
His exact words were that he would review our requests.
Another man chimed in.
He said we could expect an answer in 4 to 5 months.
More groans.
Unless anyone objects, said Wales, I think we should forget about Rowan Anderson for the time being and go straight to the army.
Yes, sir,
said the man beside Joe.
I've drafted a letter to send to Colonel Hodgson.
He took a letter out of his shirt pocket and unfolded it to read.
We are sure that you, as a distinguished representative of the American Army, appreciate the great number of Negro youth fighting and giving their lives for democracy and the American way of life, as well as the Negroes here on the home front laboring to make the war effort possible. We simply request 25 or 30 homes to accommodate the Negro workers with families currently unable to live near the worksite, constructed to the same standards as those built for white families.
People called out affirmations. Shirley spoke in a commanding voice.
I think you need to soften it.
Wales nodded.
You may be right.
Shirley continued.
Add something like, we'd be grateful. White folks like it when we beg.
When we gonna do something about our wages?
Asked the man beside Joe. Wales looked the man in the eye.
Our wages are good, Leroy.
Not as good as white men's wages.
Be that as it may, our first priority has to be housing. The situation at the moment is untenable for Negro families.
Joe didn't know what that meant, but could guess. There were more murmurs of agreement. Leroy crossed his arms and leaned back in his chair.
What about the buses?
Another man asked.
Half the time they don't stop for colored men.
That's true, said Ralph.
Maybe we should mention the buses in the letter to the colonel.
Wales shook his head.
I know the buses are a problem, but I truly believe our best strategy is to focus on one issue at a time.
Some men nodded, others grumbled in disagreement. The discussion went on like this for some time. Men brought up all the various difficulties with Negro life in Oak Ridge, and Wales tried to convince them to wait to try and solve them until the housing had been improved. Joe was impressed with his consistency, and the very fact that Wales never faltered began to persuade Joe that he must know what he was doing. Finally, he seemed to wear them all down. It was resolved that Wales would send his letter with Shirley's revisions to Colonel Hodgson on behalf of the council. Joe and Ralph walked Shirley back to the women's quarters.
What did you think, Joe?
Shirley asked.
Mr. Wales seems like a real smart man.
He is. We're lucky to have him.
They had to walk through the men's hutman area to get to the women's side. Ralph held Shirley's hand as they walked, and Joe tried to hang back to give them privacy. It had turned cold when the sun went down and the streets were quiet. But as they reached the far side of the Hutmans, Joe could hear men shouting. Ralph put his arm around Shirley, protective. They slowed their walk as the sounds grew closer. Two men stumbled out into the street from behind a hut in a struggle. The larger man threw a punch and knocked the smaller one back. Joe then saw that the smaller man was Otis. Ralph let go of Shirley and ran in between the men.
"Back away!"
he shouted to the large man. Joe followed. The last thing he wanted was to get in a fight on behalf of Otis, but he couldn't leave Ralph out there by himself.
"Get on out of here!" Ralph yelled to the man.
The big man considered Joe and Ralph. Otis shook himself off and walked back to join them. Otis gave his opponent a crooked smile.
"You want to take another shot? Not so brave now, is you?"
"Otis!" shouted Ralph in annoyance. He turned back to the man.
"I said, get on out!"
"Tell your friend he best not cheat at dice no more," said the man.
"I didn't cheat,"
said Otis.
"Otis, shut up,"
said Ralph. The man spat on the ground and turned to walk away. When he was a safe distance back, Ralph went over to Shirley.
"You all right?"
She nodded. Joe turned to Otis.
"You need to watch yourself."
"I didn't cheat,"
repeated Otis.
"You just don't want to pay what he owed me."
"Gambling ain't nothing but trouble, Otis,"
said Ralph. Otis rolled his eyes and turned into the night.
"Thanks for your help,"
he shouted over his shoulder.
"Come on," said Ralph. "Let's go."
When they came to the gate to the women's area, Joe stayed back to let the young people have a moment to themselves. He was anxious to get on home and get to bed.
"It'll be up again at 5:30 tomorrow for the morning shift."
He looked over to see if Ralph was done. He and Shirley were wrapped in an embrace, mouth to mouth, arms around each other. Joe looked away quickly. A moment later, Ralph was by his side.
"Ready to go on home?"
Joe asked. Ralph nodded, and they walked in silence back to the Hutman. Chapter 12 The city looked different to June the morning after her first date with Sam. Everything had a purpose she now understood. She saw the maintenance men and factory workers on the bus and thought, "You are all here to build a bomb." The sprawling facilities at Y-12 made sense. Her job wasn't a mindless turning of meters, but rather an effort toward a specific outcome, building the most destructive weapon in history. It was one of those January mornings when the sun makes up for its abbreviated time in the sky by shining with exaggerated brilliance. Buildings gleamed in the brightness, people seemed encouraged by the light, and the whole scene added to June's sense of renewal. She had a strong, slightly ridiculous sense that she was changed, and nothing would ever be quite the same. It wasn't just being in love, though she was hopelessly, madly, desperately in love. She also had a profound sense of hope and possibility. Sam was completely unexpected, and meeting him, loving him, was extraordinary. June had never really expected anything extraordinary to happen to her. Some children imagine growing up to be movie stars, baseball players, the president, but not June. Until today, it had not occurred to her that life could hold surprises on this scale. That she could be having an affair with an important scientist, a Jew from New York, was incredible. That she could be building a bomb that would change the course of world events. That she could be in on the secret that none of these other girls turning knobs and dials had an inkling of. That someone like Sam might exist, that she could meet him, that he could want her. It was all too wonderful to believe. She wasn't naive enough to think that because he'd slept with her, he loved her, and she knew men were perfectly capable of abandoning girls in these situations. But she didn't regret it. She wanted to be with him again, and as soon as possible. She was reacting slowly at work, hardly able to concentrate, fingers fumbling, taking twice as long as usual to correct the position of the dials. She hadn't really slept. After she had dozed for maybe an hour at Sam's, he had walked her back to the dormitory, and she sneaked in as quietly as possible. Cece was asleep, but must have noticed how late June was getting home. She'd already worked out her story, that she'd been with Sally in her room and fallen asleep. It was feeble, but the best she could do. Sam was waiting for her at lunch.
She was ravenous, despite her exhaustion, or perhaps because of it, and he laughed, watching her devour her macaroni and cheese. He seemed happier than normal, definitely happy to see her, and if he had any plans of abandoning her, it didn't seem like it. By now, all the girls she worked with must have known something was going on between them. When lunch was over, he asked if she'd like to go to the movies with him that night. She could swear she felt her heart swelling. It was a silly notion, but she could feel it in her chest. They began spending their evenings together regularly. Usually every other night or so, they went to the movies or the canteen together. No announcement was ever made, but June soon realized they were going steady. They met for lunch in the cafeteria when she was on the day shift and ate supper together most evenings. She let him keep drinking, of course, too flushed with love to want to pick a fight, but he hardly drank much with her anyway, and she never had more than a single beer after that first night. It sometimes amazed her how much they had to say to each other. She found herself telling him the craziest thoughts in her head, things she thought she could never share with anyone. Her wondering about Ronnie in heaven, her thoughts about the other girls at Y-12 flirting in the cafeteria, even the Hollywood romances she made up to keep herself entertained at work. He didn't seem to think she was crazy. He laughed at her in a good-natured way or listened seriously, asking her questions, surprising her with his genuine interest in her thoughts. He talked, too. He told her stories about his family, about growing up in the city. He told her about his father, who had studied science in Germany, but when he came to New York, could only find work in a bakery. Sam had just gotten his doctorate when his father died, and he was so proud that his son would become the scientist he'd never had a chance to be. His mother was still living in Brooklyn and wrote him letters in Yiddish once a week. June thought the strange script was beautiful, but Sam rolled his eyes at the letters as he translated them for her. They were mostly full of complaints about her health, the neighbors, his brother-in-law, rationing, the heating in her apartment building. June suspected Sam exaggerated some in his translations, but she helped him come up with kind, caring replies in any case. He wrote back in English, which she said his mother should be able to read and even write, if only she would set her mind to it. Sam also talked to her about the bomb they were making. This was only when they were alone and could be sure no one could hear them, usually in the evening, in his room. She had so many questions to ask. What was she doing at her job? What were the dials measuring? What was happening at Y-12? Slowly, he explained it to her, and she became familiar with all sorts of words: uranium, enrichment, cyclotron, fission, sustained reaction. And finally, the name of the very machine she was working on, the Calutron. So she came to learn that there were indeed giant magnets in the Calutron, and that they were separating uranium isotopes for a bomb that was being designed somewhere in New Mexico by many of the world's greatest physicists. It didn't make the job any less boring, but it felt satisfying to know the truth. Sam explained to her that they were working on a radical new way of producing energy. A bomb was just one awful way of using energy. One day, atomic energy might be used to create electricity. But in the meantime, it would be used to kill.
Since she was helping build it, did that make her responsible for the lives it might take?
Was she like Ronnie now, something of a soldier, at least in the respect that she was helping to kill the enemy?
Men and women all across the country worked in factories building guns and planes and all other instruments of war.
The planes and guns would kill people as surely as a bomb. They were all part of the war effort. Yet now that she knew the truth, her part seemed bigger than that of any riveter or welder. This was completely different from going for evening walks with Ronnie. These were real conversations with a real boyfriend, and she felt for Sam the way she knew she was supposed to. They kissed whenever they got the chance and held hands at the movies. He even carried her over one of the giant mud puddles in front of the canteen one night. She laughed and felt foolish and was spectacularly happy. One evening, she met him at the cafeteria as he was getting off work. She was on the night shift that week and had spent the afternoon trying to get some sleep, her mind working against her as she tossed and turned, never able to get used to the schedule. The idea was that she could eat breakfast while he had supper, but she was lightheaded from exhaustion and didn't feel hungry. "Could we just go for a walk?" she asked. They strolled along the boardwalk. The sun was dipping toward the horizon, the air growing colder by the minute, but she didn't mind, with her arm locked around his, the warmth from his body meeting her own.
"I feel lucky I don't have to work the night shift," he said.
"You are lucky. I feel like death warms."